At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Taxes was waiting around for your taxes to be done, which led to worrying about not getting any money back. Now Taxes is matching with a TurboTax expert who can do your taxes in a day to get you up to $4,000 fast with a refund advance loan. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Expert filing only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Refund advance has $0 loan fees and 0% APR. Refund advance loans may be issued by First Century Bank, N.A. or Web Bank. Terms apply, subject to approval.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Decade Project on One Heat Minute Productions. Patreon, it does what it says on the tin. 10 years, we look back, we cast our eye back to the movies that are still hanging around and still resonating. And this very specific example is extremely pertinent because literally right now, as we're recording this around the world, a brand new movie directed by Wes Ball, the guy behind the Maze Runner movies, The Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, has been released. But 10 years ago, arguably the best entry in the franchise since perhaps 1968's The Planet of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, directed by Matt Reeves, starring Andy Serkis as Caesar, Gary Oldman, Australia's very own gruff and grumbly Jason Clarke, and the internet's king this week in the release of The Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, Toby Kebbell as Koba.
Man, love him so much.
And who would I want to talk to more than someone who truly understands the importance of keeping the apes in your apes together strong? One of my favorite film critics in the world, one of my favorite people in the world, it's Roxana Haddadi. Hello, my friend.
Hey, buddy. Hello. I'm so excited to talk about this with you. I've done my research, and by that I mean I've rewatched it every night for the past week. So
this is why you come on the show. That's my kind of research. Just put it on a loop.
Just put it on. Yeah.
Yours. I want to protect mine. It's our only chance for peace.
Are you aware?
No!
They are going to turn on you.
They're animals!
Caesar, you're home.
Who was that?
A good man like you.
Caesar, love humans more than apes.
If you threaten his family, he will retaliate.
Don't shoot! Don't you move!
Should we shoot him?
Maybe.
Whoa. Hey.
Oh, you want a drink?
Oh, okay. All right.
Easy.
All right.
What are you doing?
I'm saving the human race.
Oh my God.
military. They're already on their way.
Caesar, you have to go.
Go where? This is my home. I'm sorry, my friend. War has begun.
Caesar!
Ten years ago, this movie comes out after Rise of the Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which is Rupert Wyatt's entry into the series. Sort of human based, happens a couple of years before. It makes a bit of a splash, largely because of just absolutely outstanding visual effects and taking the series right into new areas. We'd sort of had the failure of Mark Wahlberg starring Tim Burton Planet of the Apes. People were sort of seeking a way to get the franchise back. It comes back. Really, the film crescendos probably in the last 5 minutes of the Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the captivity scenes, young Draco Malfoy in there being a prick, get your hands off me, you damn dirty ape, and the like. But in 2014, he hands it over to Matt Reeves, who at that time was, he hadn't really identified himself as like, he'd had his own voice in like, I mean, I guess, would you call Cloverfield sort of him? That's Matt Reeves's voice ish. It's hard to say. It's like Bad Robot-y, JJ.
I think that's hard
Abrams-y.
To say. It's I think that's hard. I think maybe the Let the Right One In.
That's what I was going to say. That's probably the one. Yeah, that's more his voice. Yeah. So,
I think it's more his visual style, more his voice, more of like a, I'm going to give you these sort of images that are soaked with like grandeur and doom.
Yes.
And then that takes us into Dawn.
And so then we get to Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Everyone was like seemingly down for it. We're like, oh, okay, well, maybe this is just, you know, a franchise cash grab at the time. It's 2014. The Marvel Cinematic Universe is really picking up steam and people are looking for franchises to be a contender in that big box office area. And so the film is released and it gets absolutely sensational critical appraisal, huge box office pull. And I can remember personally the second that I saw the sort of prologue of the movie end, which is sort of saying that the simian flu has wiped out most of the human race. It cuts to black and it opens with Caesar's eyes as the focal point of the screen, and you watch it pull back and all of the apes are together. They're painted in war party makeup. They're hunting together. I was like, oh, this is different. This is
drastically different. Yes.
So much different. Do you remember your first experience of seeing it? I saw it. I was completely blown away. I was instantaneously like, I have to see that again. Saw it multiple times at the cinema, bought the Blu-ray as soon as it came out, watched it a countless times at the time of release. Do you remember your first time catching it?
I think I have this memory, and I could be conflating this with War for the Planet of the Apes, but I don't think I am. And I'm pretty sure that I saw it with a friend of mine named Julian Lytle, who is also a film critic and writes and draws comics and is a big, like, original Planet of the Apes franchise fan.
Yes.
So he really came into it with like the franchise knowledge that I did not have much of, right? I was just coming into it, to your point, as like a, all right, it's a sequel. Where can it go? Like, I've seen Let the Right One In. Like, I sort of have an idea of what this could be. And exactly to your point, that first image of the war party is just like, okay, so this is gonna go really fucking hard. Like, this has no reason to go this hard. And like, thinking about Rise, yes, has that like final 10-15 minutes. It has the excellent midway point when Caesar says no for the first time.
Oh yeah.
But I can't think of anything visually past the image of apes on horses that really stuck out to me.
Yeah.
Whereas that war party line and how Matt Reeves and this film's script like immediately put you into the sense of years have passed, we've grown this idea now into something that is a civilization and a way of life, and there is brutality here and organization here. There's so much suggested in that first image, right? And then it really takes us into a place, I think, I mean, we'll talk about so many of these set pieces, but this film, like, one set piece after another, I'm just like, I don't know how you did this.
I don't know how you didn't have real apes shooting this. But yeah, I think at the time, it really made a splash. Lots of people loved it. It really kicked off the conversation, I feel, that kind of, because it was 2014, we'd already had, you know, 2001, 2, and 3 of The Lord of the Rings, and talking about performance capture, and particularly Andy Serkis as the leader of performance capture, and going like, well, this guy's kind of in three of the biggest movies ever, probably the best enduring trilogy of our lifetimes. Easily hands down the best fandom, Lord of the Rings fandom, as far as memes and staying a part of the culture.
Keeping the conversation alive all the time.
All the time, just with beautiful things. Shout out to the lady who looks at Lord of the Rings characters and tells you how good their cunnilingus game would be.
I just saw a meme that my partner showed me that his coworker sent him, which was like the Fast and the Furious franchise if they were Lord of the Rings movies.
Yes.
Like, I love that. I love the ability to like mix together ideas. Shout out to all the Lord of the Rings fans out there.
Love you guys. But then 2014 comes around. People have been talking about it a little bit with Rise, but I think this is the one where people are like, actually, is performance capture like on the level of artistry as just simply acting, and should it be individually recognized? Because people are like, one of my favorite performances of 2014 is Andy Serkis as Caesar. Yeah. But it seems weird to say I'm going to put the ape as like my best actor nomination because you're kind of not allowed. I mean, I would have.
Is it deserved?
You could have nominated Toby Kebbell's Koba as best supporting actor that year. Let's go. This is what we're doing.
100%. Can we look up the Oscars?
I'm
going to
look up
that
the Oscars. Right. We've got to just suss this out because this is really important.
Well, because I'm 100% sure there's someone that we're going to find that we're like, wow, that guy sucks. Why did that guy get in there?
Okay. So, oof.
Oh, yeah, I've pulled it up too. 20... Yeah, there are some people. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know what? 2015, as it turns out, ladies and gentlemen, just to give you the heads up, we've got Benedict Cumberbatch. I like him a lot in Imitation Game. Really enjoy that film. You got Michael Keaton in Birdman. For whatever folks have to say about that movie, I think his performance is incredible. You've then got the batshit Bradley Cooper American Sniper performance, and the winner, The Theory of Everything with Eddie Redmayne, a movie that has aged so poorly, and his performance
so
in it.
So poorly.
And I would happily put Andy Serkis in there as Caesar. Let's go to supporting role. Look, now this would be the tough hang. Supporting role has Ruffalo and Foxcatcher. Very good.
Very good.
Edward Norton, Birdman. Fine.
Fine.
Didn't rate it. Ethan Hawke in Boyhood, though. Very good.
Hawk can slide. Hawk is not part of the problem here. He can stay.
Robert Duvall and the Judge. That's a career nomination. I do really like that movie. I get it.
Sure.
But J.K. Simmons is there for Whiplash. I would have liked to see Toby get a nom. He's not winning against J.K.
He's not winning against J.K., but I think Toby could 100% have Norton's nom.
Oh, easy.
And what's really fascinating, and this isn't like a divergent we have to go on too long, but I would love to consider what a deserved nom for Toby would have done for his career. Because I think he's had a really interesting career. He's done other like motion capture work. He's done like interesting supporting character work. He did Servant. Yeah. He's on For All Mankind, which is one of my favorite shows. But like, Serkis really has carved a path for himself that no longer needs awards. He should have one. But like, Andy doesn't need them to continue getting work.
No,
you know what I mean?
And he's got such a wonderful career now, Andy, of like, quirky character roles, like pops up in Black Panther as that claw guy. I always forget his name. But he pops up as the claw guy. He pops up in one of our favorite series of recent years, Andor, in an incredible multi-episode arc.
Incredible.
Role. He does that. Yeah. Then he's second unit directing on the Hobbit trilogy, which is starting to dip his toe into the directing pool. And then he goes off and makes like a couple of Venom movies. Just like great.
Does
and
Venom, now, does Mowgli. Yeah.
And now he's moving on to his own Gollum Lord of the Rings movie where he'll be directing and starring. So, you know, when we talk about how these actors, I think about that a lot with Toby Keller. And I also think the kind of like gargantuan disaster that was the Fantastic Four that kind of put that centered on him. Like it's a sliding doors moment of like people kind of like, I don't know, for whatever reason going, it must've been Toby Kebbell's fault. It's like, wait a second. Miles Teller's gone off to make a million things. Michael B. Jordan's gone off to make a million things. Surely it's not Toby Kebbell's fault. Like as Dr. Doom, it's not his fault. They were making a body horror Fantastic Four that no one wanted. It was just kind of like, that's what it is. And our man, Jason Clarke, Aussie boy, Jason Clarke, like in the seminal scene of the Academy Award winning Best Picture, Oppenheimer, screaming at Cillian Murphy for 2 hours. You know, he's definitely a guy who's like around working still excellent. And I will say your girl, Kerry Russell from The Americans.
Yes. I was like, where are we going? Are we going to Kate Mara? Are we still talking about Fantastic Four?
No, screw Fantastic Four. We're jumping over here. There's other people in this cast and that are around here who are all ridiculously either A, successful at the point that they arrive at this movie, or B, bounce off into other things. Whereas Toby's that one who kind of, what's strange, like I'm going to quickly jump to like the 10 years from now. I never thought I could be so happy now today, 2024, seeing the internet and especially Twitter and Instagram get taken over by Cobra memes on the release.
I love it. The only thing that made me upset again is that none of it was like Toby Kebbell as Cobra, right? It was like, it was treating Cobra like he was like a computer generated entity. And when you realize that it's an actor who is doing that stuff, I mean, I think like, There's so much physicality in this role. There's so much on his face in this role. I mean, we'll talk about more of it in detail, but like the scene, the first fight scene between the two of them, when Caesar like overpowers him and then Koba has to like on his knees, like swear fealty. That is devastating stuff, right? Like you can see how much that is destroying him, destroying Koba, to have to like take the knee to someone who he really at this point no longer respects, loves, but no longer respects. Like that is like Godfather shit. That is like Fredo, Michael Corleone shit. Like that is great stuff. And I love it so much. And I think we don't have to talk about Kingdom a lot, but I think this movie and War really take some suggested ideas in Rise about how we treat animals and about how we assert our dominance as the human species. And those movies just do such a exceptional job turning those ideas and making us think about like, how does a society organize itself, right? Like what makes a civilization? Like how do you
when do you go from care, togetherness, thinking about the future, to dominance? When's 100%. The tipping point? And I think that you and I are very much just like this movie. I think it ties perfectly, and forgive the tangent to get there, but it's like when I watch Dawn and Koba, it's actually the scene before he overpowers him. When he pleads to Caesar, they tortured me. They lie.
Oh my God.
He's like,
human work. Yeah. Human work.
Yeah. He's like, this is what they do. And he's like, trust me, apes together, strong. Like we're together. I'm going to show them. I think I don't like the idea of the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes movie moving beyond this idea that like the human tragedy and the human awfulness can be just forgotten and forgiven. I'm yes, kind of like,
I agree.
If the bad character is an ape who wants to get weapons to protect ape kind and dominate, like again, mm-hmm. just for his own fiefdom on the globe, I don't really care about that. If it's at the expense of the humans, I'm like, well, we kind of had it coming. We had it coming.
We had our shot. We had like thousands of years. We had our shot. It's so funny because Kingdom is what, like 200 years in the future?
200 years something. Yeah.
Like 200 something. And humans are like, we just can't take it anymore, man. I think if that movie had like a more distinct political perspective and like more willingness to say, and humanity is flawed to think this way.
Yes.
I think I would feel a lot more fondness for it. But that's exactly what Dawn does, right? You have these very empathetic characters, like Jason Clarke's character, Carrie Russell's character. Like they are survivors. They have lost people. We learn they lost. Jason Clarke lost a wife. Carrie Russell lost a daughter. Like they're just scraping by. They just want to get like the electricity back on so that their people can survive. But you also have like Gary Oldman's character who's like, we'll kill all the apes if they don't let us, right? Like there is this still this like specter of menace that makes Koba's ideology feel so correct.
Yes.
It is still the like Professor Charles Xavier Magneto question, right?
Oh.
It is this forever
and in the language of one
idea.
The language of One Heat Minute, Magua was right.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, yes, you know? So it's like, it's very painstakingly explored within the script between these conversations with Caesar and Koba, where like I understand both sides. Like you don't feel like Caesar is capitulating, right? You don't feel like he's acquiescing, but you get where he's coming from. But I also like when Koba is pointing at all the scars on his body, right, from like medical research and abuse, and he's saying that's human work, like that is heartbreaking stuff. Like I wish that like a quarter of as many, like any percentage of the blockbusters that we get had that level of care about exploring, like, why do characters act the way they do? What is the mindset that takes them there?
Yes.
And when we talk about like Michael Mann movies, right? Like those movies are exceptional at that, like that level of like hinting at backstory and conveying ideology and emotion, like, it's so rare that we get that. And it's so rare to get that in like a gigantic franchise picture, but Dawn pulls it off.
It's so special that also you see like they riff so perfectly on an idea in Rise, which is kind of very passively done because Rise feels like a more of a momentum driven story. It's like, how do I get the apes to talk? And it feels like the script is on wheels in certain respects of like, how do we get there? How do we get there? How do we get there? Hubris, scientific hubris, you know, accident, blah, James Franco's character kills the world. Fair enough.
Oh, well.
And
our
you
bad.
Get that, but it's like the peak of human existence in some ways, which you see reflected in in Caesar and Koba's race, you got the dastardly awfulness of human existence is the exploitation of other mammals on this planet for testing and stuff like that. And you even I even feel it in a more heightened sense for like Maurice, you know, because you see orangutans, I just think they're the most beautiful, sacred, sage, wise, I don't know, like they're like an antenna to the feelings of the universe. And I feel like if you ever tortured or captured or hurt one of those things, that there's like such a karmic darkness going to follow you and every person in your life forever.
Like,
I just
there's something dead inside of you, like if you are able to do that. And the film goes there, right? Like It and tells you.
And so it goes to that like family, child rearing, the beautiful joy of like babies and how everything happens. And that's like the joyful end, you know, raising your child up, thinking about their future, da da da. All that beautiful stuff is connected. And then you've got Koba. And so you can just see what's so great about both Koba and Caesar. They're the same. They've got a lot of the same outlook and they've got a lot of the same stuff, but just one of them anticipates, I've been tortured my entire life and you've been reared and cared for. We're coming at things in the same position. We're even coming things in the middle. We're coming to certain compromises, but it's just one is like, I am anticipating that humans are going to do the awful thing and you're anticipating and hoping for and seeing that there's only the good because you've seen the good in your immediate direct experience.
Right.
But you know, you forget in Rise that Caesar was captured. He was taken into that sanctuary. He was taken in with the other apes. He was there. And so you see he has experienced it. He's touched it. But the thing that he keeps thinking about is the hope. And maybe that distance of 10 years is the hope for him, whereas Koba's reflex, even after 10 years, is like, you know, because in Dawn, it's set 10 years after Rise, basically. It's like,
right.
After that 10 years, all I remember is the bad stuff. All I remember is the torture and them not being around keeps me so happy. But that trigger of them being back means I know that in 1 second, if we don't negotiate with them, humans think of themselves as better than us and we're dead or they're going to try and kill us. And so, you know, their scenes together are so tragic and awful, but it leads to what I think is ultimately, in a movie that's already almost like a 9 or 10 out of 10, like a 50 out of 10 scene of Koba going and securing weapons and pretending he's some silly monkey. And it is just, that is a scene. Thank the gods for things like YouTube. You can just dial it up any time of the day or night and watch that 3 or 4 minutes of this movie and be completely wowed. And you can even do an extra set of Googling and see the one where they take the ape mask off of Toby Kebbell and you watch him do the performance to marvel at just how magnificent he is underneath the digital.
It's amazing. Injury.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I interviewed him about For All Mankind, I brought up his character in For All Mankind is a working class sort of like engineer character who ends up on Mars, and Mars has been colonized. And basically there is a like two-tier system where it's like the astronauts are like the higher classes, the workers are the lower classes. Spoiler alert, he plays a character who helps lead an uprising against the astronaut upper classes. And I asked him about like how that compared to Koba and if he saw them in the same way. And he, you know, it's always one of those things where like when an actor says something, you're like, oh, this is such a nice thing. And I hope this is true. but he was like, I hadn't really thought about it like that. And so we went on this tangent of talking about Koba and how like the huge like circus smile that he does in that scene was like his idea, and how he had gone for research to like an ape sanctuary and the doctor showing him around was like, smiles are the most menacing things that apes can do, like we perceive it as a smile, they don't. So it's so fascinating to get like that read on that scene. But that, I mean, him grabbing the gun, the look on his face when he has the gun. I mean, all of those things, it's incredibly compelling to watch. And it's also the kind of thing as you're watching it where you realize the movie is going to turn in a certain way that it will not be able to come back from.
Yes.
Right? Like the narrative cannot double back on itself. It is not like I say this with some degree of animosity. It is not like an MCU situation where you could be like, we figured out a way to like break time and reverse all of this, right? Like Koba breaking bad is a choice. And it is a choice that like almost destroys their community while at the same time defending it. And so there are so many like shades there. I'm curious if there are any other scenes for you in the film that come close to that, Because rewatching it, I think there's so many like beautiful moments, but I'm wondering if there's anything else that you like pull up and rewatch.
I watch Maurice scenes because I love orangutans. I just can't. And then I'm like, who played Maurice? And I go down the line and you're like, holy shit, it's Karen Connival plays Maurice. And I'm just like, now that's, so if you don't know Karen Connival, she actually appears 10 years later as Maurice again in Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, but is in a bunch of things. She's in Charmed and Supergirl TV series, The Good Doctor, etc. So I like the Maurice scenes. I really do. But for me, sometimes it's just it's little quiet moments that get me in this movie. I think this movie really relishes some quiet moments. Like, I also love the anticipation, and it's all in the build up as well. I think once things are happening, it's moving, it's got a bit more of a motor. But just like, I love the anticipation of Jason Clarke's character walking to their home the first time, like how terrifying that is. And when you see the forearm of the gorilla just behind him, and then he stands up, and then all these huge silverbacks stand up, and that sort of stuff. It's like
production design of that, right? That they almost, it looks like trees have been like stripped of bark and made into these like gigantic, like jagged, like fence pieces, right? Yeah. That are like, it's almost like you're descending in a doorway to hell. the angles are all wrong. It is made out of organic material and you're in the forest, but it just feels malevolent, right? Like, there is so much in that long walk that is very ominous, and yet
but it's pivoted
before.
It's completely contrasted with the beautiful hearty kids playing stuff. So I love that in that moment the film anchors its POV to the human character, and it feels like you're descending into hell, whereas it feels like a beautiful, you know, a primitive architectural wonder with lights and apes crossing, river crossing through waterfalls, you know, and that sort of thing. And you're
get to the tree, and the tree is clearly this like holy, sacred, beautiful object that they have built a staircase around, right? Like, you really get a sense of how this, I mean, Caesar says this when they come to the human compound to basically tell them to like stay the fuck away from them. Caesar is like, so this is this is our home, right? And like, you're not going to take our home from us. And there is just so much, like you put it so beautifully, the perspective shifts in this movie, I think, are really, really good. And you get certain scenes where the perspective shifts over and over. I'm thinking about the scene where Carrie Russell's character and her like stepson figure, played by, is it Cody Smith McPhee?
Yeah, Cody Smith McPhee, right? Another Aussie.
Another, and so like they are tending to Carver, who is like the stock human character who kills all the apes. So like, she's tending to a wound of his, and then Caesar's like baby son gets curious and comes over to see what she's doing. So you have like Carrie Russell and Cody Smith McPhee. They are like immediately smitten with baby Cornelius, right? He's like crawling all over them. They love him. Like, it's amazing. And you have Carver just like staring down this baby with like hatred in his heart, especially when Cornelius finds his hidden gun and the scene shifts, right? It becomes very violent very quickly. And there are a lot of those moments in this film, I think, where it's like, you think you're seeing one thing. The movie is almost making you think, surely humans and apes could get along, right?
Like, can't we all just come
together?
Can't
we all just get along? Like, it is really lulling you into this sense of like kumbaya. And then it interrupts it, right? It tells you things aren't that easy now in our reality. People can't get along in the present day
with other with other people, with people from other nationalities and backgrounds, with people with different religious views. We're already at that level of hostility. Imagine, like, we went, this is a This is a tangent, but for this reason. We went to Thailand, my wife and I and a couple of friends, and there was a sanctuary there for like a little ape sanctuary there where you could go and hold apes and like take a photo and stuff like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't go near it. I said no. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my wife's much smaller, daintier, much sweeter than me. Like, it's just a sanctuary. It's just whole. I go, I respect apes. I was like, I'm not taking a photo with that ape, because if that ape decides that I have done something with a fence, it can rip my face off. And 100%. So can you imagine, you see like a silverback walking down the street near you? I'd be like Cobra. I'd be like, oh my knees, put my hand up. Just like, I just, every time you walk, you see one of those, just a hand down. Just get,
there's nothing I could possibly do.
No.
That could threaten you, like nothing. You know what's really funny is that when you started saying that story, I was like, are you going to say that the apes are like class traitors for taking pictures with humans? Like, where is this?
I should have. That's an essay. No, I was just going to say that I just was so terrified, because I was just thinking genuinely, I'm like, look, with even like a giant bear, like if you see a bear at the end of your street, if you see a bear at the end of your street, for example, my house, if there's a ladder up to my roof, I can climb the ladder. I'll kick the ladder over. I can sit on the roof. The bear most likely may not be even able to climb up on the roof. It's fine. Even like something like a big cat, like a, you know, people would see like a cougar or something like that. It's like, if I get to a certain point and high up in a tree, or maybe I might get lucky, it might not be able to get to where I am in that moment.
It might just get tired, Blake. It'll just get tired and it'll be like, you know what?
It'll see a neighbor walking their dog and then it'll eat them instead. Whatever the case may be.
But an ape.
An ape. No. Or get it. If you saw a silverback running towards you, short of going into a bomb shelter or something,
there's nothing you can do. No, literally nothing.
Or get in a car, it'll rip the doors off and then rip you out of the car.
How do you now tell me how you feel about a silverback on a horse? How do you feel about that imagery in this film?
I feel like I want to die. I feel so terrified. But it's like there's an aura in this movie of power. And
oh my God. Yes.
You totally feel that. Humans have that impulse, which is why it's relatable and why the characters are so like the inner turmoil is so there, is because I don't imagine we all would hate to say that we're going to be that guy, but we all might be carvers. We all might be like that person who is just on edge, that I'm so terrified. If I feel an immediate threat, I'm going to do something stupid because that might be there. Like, we all wish we could be as zen calm like Jason Clarke's Malcolm and be impressed with Caesar. But I don't know how I would react to being carried by six silverbacks and tossed into a muddy pit with all of those things hanging around me and like Cobra hovering over me with a spike. I would just be, it's the most terrifying thing in the world.
It's absolutely terrifying. It is also, again, like some of the hardest imagery I've seen in blockbuster filming. I don't know. Who was the person in the production team who decided that the apes should have war paint? Because they are a genius.
Oh,
like the simplicity of that choice. Oh, yeah. The simplicity of that choice is amazing. It's astonishing. And yeah, I mean, like, again, like that whole scene with Carver, Oba on the tree shooting Caesar. I mean, that is such a like loaded with like tragedy moment. There is a moment in
we have to go quickly back,
please.
The hardest the scene has ever gone is when Caesar stands in front of a grizzly bear and makes him arc up, and Cobra flies. You see him fly through the air with the spear into the back of the bear's head. Speaking of going hard,
that's the opening. Like, that is the opening of the movie to show you like how much has changed in a decade, how much they have organized, how much they have figured out, how much, again, apes together strong is like an actual, like, serviceable ideology, right? Like, yeah. It is something that is real. And I think the thing, like, about these films is, like, obviously, this is very clear, but they are so much, like, an exploration of race and mm-hmm. otherness and finding paths forward as a oppressed group that allow you to flourish outside of your oppressors. And so I just think a lot about the fact that this movie takes time to suggest, as does War, that like apes together strong and building your own community away from the groups that have hurt you is like an admirable and respectable and like practical thing to do.
Yes.
And I think that is why like Kingdom changing apes together strong to together strong feels like it completely misses the point of that. Because Caesar, by the end of this film, I think realizes that humanity is not what he thought it would be, certainly is not what he remembers after what Koba has done, right? And it's like a very tangible choice to be like, we as apes will live separately. Like, we're going to create a ape ethno state and we're just going to do that.
but it's, I'm sorry to laugh at ethnostate, but I never thought I would hear it said there, but it's so true. But I also love that at the end of this movie that Caesar is almost holding a grudge and holding spite and holding vengeance in his heart for what humans did to Koba to push him to that edge.
To make him that way.
And so then that is almost the reinforcing message. It's not only the way that they act and behave when you think of humanity as a collective, as this mob collective of other, and you've got this ape society, this ape species thinking like more collectively, but yeah, it totally makes sense. It's so weird that you said that, because there was like, I was listening to a couple of podcasts and people were talking about, there was during the segregation era in African America, there were African Americans in the United States, because of segregation and businesses had to be completely separated. There were some African American business people and companies and technology makers and clothing makers that emerged in that part of that, what was being a forced kind of ethno state, to your point, sure, that thrived, that made money, mm-hmm. that had everything. And mm-hmm. then the Jim Crow era came, and then there was the sort of reintegration. All of those businesses mm-hmm. just got smashed to pieces. And so mm-hmm. it is one of those things where it's like, the Apes franchise all the way from like 1968, which, I mean, I think it's even an even more naked sort of look at, you know, social political issues in the late 1960s when this movie emerges. Absolutely. It's like that, it's a great quandary. And I love how you said that, do we need to be with the people that hurt us? You know, it's almost like at the time when, you know, the formation of firstly India and then India and Pakistan, it's like, England, get out. It's just like,
just get out.
Get out. How's that? Just get out. Like, it's time to be gone. We don't want you here anymore. We're going to make our, you know, a Muslim state, and we're going to make a Buddhist state. And this is how it's going to work. And you need to leave immediately. Hindu state. Rather.
And of course, and the thing too about like that in and of itself is like, and I don't want to be the person, this doesn't need to become a political podcast, but we see this constantly, right? Yeah. I mean, like in India right now, there is like a widespread anti-Muslim movement. Yeah. Like pretty much, I think what you will find with any ethnostate is there are portions of it that are very based on like commonality, and then there are parts of it that are based on exclusion, because that's just how our brains work, right? Yep. That's any society. And again, the fact that these films question that, the fact that Caesar in War for the Planet of the Apes is haunted by Koba, and haunted by the fact that he had to kill them, and considers, like, did I make the right choice? Like, is there anywhere that we can be free and be safe? Like, when he meets Bad Ape, and Bad Ape is like such a mirror of Koba, right? Like, he has also lived through horrible things.
Yes.
But his way of dealing with them was having like a almost like a fondness for human objects, because they reminded him of like another part of himself. So like both of these movies just do so much in terms of questioning like what creates your identity and what part of it is fixed and what part of it is malleable, while also pulling off just these astonishing action sequences. I just wanted to mention that, like, during Koba's like siege on the human compound, that one, I think it's a oneer. It's like the one long shot where the camera is like mounted on the tank.
On the tank, yeah.
Like, I just, again, like, such inspired visual storytelling in a film that is doing like semi-predictable things. Like, a big war scene is like semi-predictable, but like putting the camera on the tank as Koba is like driving the tank,
and that's
just astonishing.
And not to spoil, it's like, and then in Kingdom, it's like, no, we don't want to spoil it for people that are seeing it. It's just, there's also those remnants of human society and human dominance that want to be captured by these sentient apes that the humans don't want them to get a hold of. But it's like, that shouldn't be their fucking choice.
No.
Like, no. Do you think that humans, like, I mean, that's, if they want to get some guns, give the apes some guns. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and, yes, I agree. But also, like, the most interesting, we definitely have to put a spoiler tag somewhere.
I'm going to have to put spoilers.
Yeah. But, like, the most interesting part of Kingdom is, like, in the last 10 minutes when Noah and May have that argument, and she says, like, these were human technology, human ideas, like, they belong to humanity. And the question, I think, if you love Dawn and War, is like, do they belong to humanity? And like, why do you think you deserve weapons of war when you came so close to destroying the world numerous times over, right?
And like, the only reason that we can talk is because one of your humans created a virus that killed.
Correct.
I think, what was it? Something like, 1 in 500 survive in the prologue for Dawn. So it's like 1 in 500 of the human race survive. And then they went to, and the
virus mutates again. Yes.
And they went to war with each other.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So it's just like, there's a lot in Kingdom that I think could have been really interesting, but I think it's interested in the human ape dilemma.
Yes.
Whereas I think Dawn and War are really the ape dilemma, and humans just happen to like be there. Like, even War, with like Woody Harrelson as the bad guy, like, to me, it is the specter of Koba and Caesar's guilt and the apes that have chosen to align with the humans in War that are the real like enemies. Like, I just think it is,
those ideas are so rich. The ideas in Dawn and War are so profoundly rich, whilst you can enjoy Kingdom. And as a passive, you know, very low expectation person, because Dawn is so high, it certainly has enjoyable things, but it doesn't, the depths that you can scratch, like, we said ethno state on this podcast, like, the depths that you can scratch with Dawn and War would not be something I'd mention on Kingdom. Like, it's just not, it wouldn't be the same. And so, look, I guess in the wrap up, the thing that we've learned, you know, in 10 years is that somewhat surprisingly to some, but not a surprise to anyone who is in our community, the Planet of the Apes franchise is an infinitely rich thing that can be taken a multitude of ways. And it makes us maybe one of the most strong sci-fi franchises possible, because if you take it anywhere along a timeline, you can play with these ideas and play with this fun, and the stories that we've seen are so amazing. So the fact that there's more and probably more to come, it'll probably make some money. It's looking like it's making some good money internationally at the moment, and they can go further and explore and maybe get into some of the Dawn and War themes in this latest series. Makes it really exciting. Andy Serkis is a colossal star.
Yes.
He was already a colossal star in Lord of the Rings. He comes in and does these series of movies. He's now a filmmaker in his own right. But man alive, is he good. And just like, how awesome is that we've barely mentioned like that a movie stars Gary Oldman, Kerry Russell, Cody Smith-McPhee, like Jason Clarke. Like we've barely mentioned how fucking amazing the supporting cast is and how incredibly well that they have all aged being in this movie.
Yes.
But like,
yes.
Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is so rich that like the quandaries that you're facing between two digitally made up characters of Toby Kebbell and Andy Serkis as Caesar and Cobra dwarf Gary Oldman.
I love that we basically our discussion of their performances was like they're also there, like they are present.
They are
in
present.
This film.
But the film is there. These two guys. It's these two guys.
It's
these two apes. It's that and the forces between them, and I. That's the only thing that I think is like a lightning bolt, and I'm so glad that Matt Reeves seems to have been struck by it. The first time Caesar sees Cobra in the ape facility in San Francisco, and how exquisite that performance capture is, and how exquisite his face looks in the cage. I just remember that and thinking, oh, who is that? Like, he's got a story. And this is the story. And this is the story.
This is the story. Yeah. The last things that I want to say are that the score is exceptional, right?
Yes.
Like, Michael Giacchino has gone on to do, like, amazing things. A very fun thing you should do is watch Dawn and watch War and then watch The Batman. The three scores are incredibly similar.
Yes.
And I think you'll really have like a fun time picking up on like some of his patterns and quirks and how he builds tension. I think that's fun. The other thing is if you are someone who enjoys reading like novel adaptations of films, I was invited onto the Authorized podcast.
We know them. They're good fun.
They're good to talk about the book that was written that covers the time in between Rise and Dawn.
Really?
It's called Dawn of the Planet of the Apes Firestorm. And it's basically about like the, you know, like humanity crumbling. How did Dreyfus like come to be in power? Who were some of the people involved in trying to round up the apes? And it gives you a ton of Cobra backstory.
Oh,
it's
great.
Basically just like a glimpse into his life before he meets Caesar, and I think it's worth reading. Like, it's fine. It's like $5 online. Just buy it. Why not?
We'll love the Authorized guys, and that's fun. That's a good one.
Yeah,
couldn't have come up with a better name than Firestorm for the authors there. Come on, like
I'm pretty sure, right? Like, I think it's called Firestorm. I'm gonna double check just so that I'm not wrong.
But I also just mean
Firestorm.
And can I also just say, if you ever want some fun, go down and look at who plays the apes. Judy Greer plays Cornelia.
Yes.
Terry Notary from The Square plays Rocket. You're like, what are you talking about?
It's mind blowing. Yeah.
And he's also, you know, done a bunch of different Navi stuff on like Avatar and was in the Hobbit movies and stuff like that. But it's like, it is so hilarious to go back and go like, who was an ape and how great were they? It's just, I think I'm so glad we got to talk about this. I'm so keen for people. I'm so glad that there's another apes movie out that's at the cinema. They maybe see it. They think, man, I want to check out those other apes movies. I think if you could skip Rise, as far as I'm concerned, if you just go straight, all right, how about this? Go to the second half of Rise, or the first half, skip it. Second half of Rise, watch it, and then motor into Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. It's so, so exquisite. Truly one of my favorite sci-fi movies of all time.
Oh, absolutely. The only thing I would say is I think Rise is worth watching to better understand. Sorry to everyone who made Rise, to better understand what a massive step up Dawn is.
I thought you were going to be like, I thought you were going to be coming to shipping for Rise. I'm like, where is this going?
No.
No. Yes, actually,
No.
no. Watch Rise, a movie that stars disgraced James Franco and very cool John
Yes.
Lithgow. Watch the
Very cool
movie.
John Lithgow. Frida Pinto's in
Freda
it. David
Pinto's in it.
Oyelowo's
Yeah,
in
yeah,
it.
yeah.
Yeah,
Good.
it's like perfectly serviceable. And then Dawn starts, and you're like, holy fucking shit. How did they get from there to here? And that, like,
And
it'll blow your mind.
how philosophically and sort of like intellectually sharp, like in some parts of
Yeah.
Rise, it's still like dropping quotes from the original series and doing those sorts of fun. And here it's like, it is insanely
It's
sharp.
its own
It's its own, the whole,
fucking thing.
yeah, it's its own thing. It so owns, it's, that might be the thing. It's like, it's the true lesson of like how much you can be in service of an overarching story, but be totally your own thing. And I think that this
Yes.
franchise has maybe been a bit of a gift because in certain scales of them in sometimes, like it's like the filmmakers and the creators who are working on them get to make exactly the movies they want to make for better or worse. And for me, I think that's what makes it such a fantastic franchise. And like why Dawn for me, even after watching Kingdom, and again, no, because it was the one I'd watched most immediately prior to watching Dawn. I watched Dawn again and I was like, oh, this is something different. It's so different.
100%.
It's so different.
100%. Yeah, I just think it is something different. It is something special. It clearly is something that still strikes a chord with people, given how much Coba love we saw recently. And I just think that you should buy it on physical media and own it forever.
Yes, 100%. Well, thank you to my dear friend who is different, who is special, and always strikes a chord with me, Roxana Hadady, the best, the
Thank
best.
you, Blake. Thank you, buddy.
She always gives me that big sister. Thank you. Don't give me compliments to my
Thank you. Thank
face.
you.
Fuck
Don't
off.
talk about me.
Don't talk about me.
Don't perceive me. Yeah.
Yeah, well. You're the best. I will talk to you soon. Thank you so much for doing this. Guys, you can follow Rox. You can find her on Twitter, but you can go to Vulture, where she is an absolutely outstanding TV and film critic, and you can find her there and on a bunch of other podcasting guests. Go check out The Authorized. Buy the book for $5. Go check out those lovely folks over there. They're a good time. And yeah, we'll definitely have you back to talk soon. I'm going to tell you about two new unannounced shows as soon as I hit stop on this recording.
Ooh, okay, I'm excited.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Now taxes is 100% free when you file in the TurboTax app if you didn't file with us last year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, just do your own taxes in the app by 218.
What if I have lots of forms?
All good, all 100% free.
What if I had three jobs?
Still 100% free.
What if I once saw Bigfoot?
That has nothing to do with taxes, so still 100% free.
Now that's what I'm talking about.
Now this is taxes. See if you qualify in the TurboTax app. Excludes TurboTax Live, must start and file in app by 218.